Wagner, Freud and Nietzsche in Berlin. Berlin, the 28th of March, 2016, the Schiller Theatre. The lights go down and the last sporadic clearing of throats ushers in that otherworldly theme, rich and full of promise, lifting us up through the A-flat major scale and into the realm of transcendence. Now, I'm sure many of you here will be familiar with this scene. You know, those first few bars from the Prelude of Parsifal, they kind of pave the way for a musical experience which is at once profound and ineffable. Goerlemans's testy, provocative question to Parsifal at the end of Act 1, which Tom spoke about earlier, why are you still standing there? Don't you know what you've just seen? Now, that's like a question that's posed anew to every director of the work, and indeed to each of us in the audience. What, after all, have we just seen? For Nietzsche, Wagner's one-time acolyte and subsequently his fiercest opponent, this question encapsulates in a way the curse of consciousness, which modern man carries with him when he asks himself, after experiencing something, what have I just experienced? Now, most of Nietzsche's mature philosophy was constructed in the form of aphorisms, short sort of hermetic texts. And in order to interpret them, he calls for a new type of reader who's not bound by the reflective nature of consciousness, the way that we look back, but whom the aphorism can work upon through the process which he describes as a process of rumination, like a cow digests. So reading a Nietzschean aphorism is not enough. It has to also be digested, and then its meaning will become apparent as a consequence. Now, the process of rumination in Nietzsche can be compared to that Freudian concept which Stephen G. so eloquently described earlier, of Nachfraglichkeit, and forgive my German pronunciation. He translated it as afterwardness. The first English translator of the standard edition of Freud's works, James Strachey, used the phrase deferred action. And it kind of describes a way that the meaning of a traumatic event really only becomes apparent through a later, often similar set of circumstances. So, you know, we're in a set of circumstances which in a way trigger the traumatic event that was there already, that had gone unnoticed. So you see, time takes on a very unusual perspective in this sense. Now, Tom earlier also described how the meaning of a past event or a fantasy, in the case of the Wolfman, appears afterwards, you know. And this is also the case for the eponymous hero of our opera, when, as it were, memory is mixed with desire. In this short paper, I just intend to analyse my own experience of going to the opera, Parsifal, in the manner of a Nietzschean aphorism or a Freudian traumatic scene. And just to suggest that the possible meanings of the opera can only really appear retroactively in the unconscious dialogue between the event and memory. It was after the Berlin production, that Mark was talking about earlier, directed by Dmitry Chechniakov, that I began to come aware of not so much a possible answer to Goerlemans's question, why are you still standing there? Don't you know what you've just seen? But more just a glimpse at the possible identity of the individual who poses it. Now, what I'm going to do now is just show you, if Ivan, you wouldn't mind, just a clip of the final scene of this production, just to describe the events on the stage, the setup here before we actually start. So Parsifal is in the middle. He's bringing the spear back. So he's bringing the spear back, and Amfortas, the disgraced Grail King, is sitting there with his back to us in the foreground. I want you to pay particular attention. This is about a 4-minute clip, and I also say apologies for the sound quality. I think it was a press night in Berlin, so there's lots of sort of shutters going off. But I want you to just look what happens in the foreground for the next few minutes, once the celebrants start to sing Redemption for the Redeemer. And also keep an eye on this character at the back, this rather tall. This is René Pape, and this is Goerlemans. And just watch his movements. I'm going to play the clip now, please, Ivan. Just have a look at what happens. Talk about is what happens next. So we've got this rather strange interpretation of you know, obviously Wagner's stage directions. You have Amfortas and Kundry, you know, sharing a passionate kiss in a kind of remembrance of what we've been what's been described by Goernemann's of how the actual spear was originally lost. You know, it's a sort of recreation of that scene, and you've just seen Goernemann's just walking along in between these the celebrants there. So So like I said, I'm going to talk about what happens next. But first, I'm just going to say a few words about Wagner's Grail Knight, Gurnemanns. The role of Gurnemanns is one of those really heavyweight Wagnerian roles for the lower registers. It's kind of comparable in length and demand to the sort of the role of Hans Sachs in Die Meistersinger or Wotan in one of the Ring operas, at least. Perhaps in Die Walküre, it's sort of similar structure. You know, he isn't there in one of the acts, but he does a lot of singing in the other two. Now, like Kundry, he's a composite character. You know, he's built up from three different characters in Wolfram's poem, and Wolfram von Eschenbach's poem, which is the main source that Wagner used for his libretto. Chopped and changed it a lot. It was very disparaging as well about the poem itself, but you know, obviously that was his main source, I think. He's described in Wagner's stage directions as elderly yet vigorous. And by the squires whom he educates, he's described firstly respectfully as all-knowing, and also affectionately as little father. And his role in the first act, at least, is largely expository. He recounts how the sacred relics of the spear and the grail have been sort of given to Titurel, Amfortas's father, from above, from the heavens. And that, you know, Titurel then went on to build the Grail Castle specifically to house these relics. He also tells of how Amfortas, who we saw in the foreground, lost the spear on his mission to defeat the evil sorcerer, Klingsor. Some of his other main sort of roles in the opera as well are the fact that he kind of initiates Parsifal into the rituals of the Grail community. And he also anoints him as the new Grail king, crucially, in the third act. Now, Wagner goes to a great deal of effort and length to establish the reliability of his narrator. Gurnemanns is his narrator, really. Even to the extent that he puts in his mouth the crucial philosophical message of the Good Friday music in Act 3, which Richard Bell shows in his book on Parsifal, bears a great deal of similarity to a passage from the composer's own philosophical treatise, Religion and Art. And maybe it's perhaps for this reason, at least, that he's been relatively overlooked, I think, in Wagner literature. I mean, Barry would know better than me about this, but, you know, I think there's a lot more written on Parsifal, on Amfortas and Kundry. You know, they're seen as much more kind of interesting comic characters, more open to debate. Not so much Gurnemanns. But while watching the opera in Berlin, I gradually became aware that a very different Gurnemanns was being sketched out on stage from the one that we're normally presented with. Now, just a couple of points. So firstly, at the end of Act 2, after Parsifal has regained the sacred spear and vanquished this evil sorcerer Klingsor, Kundry sets a curse on him with the following words, and this is a translation, obviously not the most adequate one, but that road you seek, that path you shall not find, for any path or passage that leads you away from me, I curse. And this is Kundry singing to Parsifal. So the curse is to any path that leads away from her. Now, after many years of wandering, Parsifal returns to the Holy Spring, the scene in Act 1. Now we're in Act 3. Sorry. And he returns to the realm of the Grail Castle after many years of wandering and many travails. And this is where Gurnemanns now resides. And he's now, in Wagner's words, a very old man, dressed as a hermit. Now, before Parsifal arrives on the scene here, Gurnemanns has already discovered Kundry, sort of lying, in Wagner's words, as if dead in the undergrowth. And Parsifal's first words in Act 3 is the phrase, I rejoice to have found you again. This is what he sings. And now he sings it according to Wagner. He sings it to Gurnemanns. But in the production, in Chechnyakov's production, he sings these words to Kundry. Now this is quite, really changes the shape of the act. You know, it's a good, very dramatic moment, because what you get from then on throughout this act is Gurnemanns continually attempting to, in psychoanalytic terms, foreclose the relationship of Parsifal and Kundry, who are continually trying to come together. You know, he's always either standing in between them or just behind them as a kind of menacing third term Now, for me, there was something really like uncanny about this activity, something like disconcerting but strangely familiar, which only began to dawn on me over the course of the next few days after the production. You know, what had I just seen on the stage here? Now, the mood around the Schiller Theatre, and some of you were there, actually, for this production, was really, like, jubilant and celebratory. You know, partly because, as luck would have it, the great Waltraud Meyer was performing her last ever Kundry, and there was a very impassioned speech by a remarkably sprightly Daniel Barenboim after sort of 4.5 hours of conducting, sort of leaping up on the stage and giving a really sort of heartfelt speech to Kundry. And, you know, because of my very inadequate German, most of it I couldn't really access, but even so, it was very moving, and everyone was felt like a real sense of community. But after that, you know, we went out for dinner again with some people that are here, and we were kind of discussing Simon Rattle's conducting in Berlin, you know, of all things, when I was suddenly remembered of a seemingly sort of lost, long-forgotten phrase that he used on a BBC Radio 3 programme. And this was a phrase that he used when he was conducting a production of Covent Garden. He said, in his habitually urbane manner, he compared conducting Gurnemanns to like playing a very slow game of tennis. You know, there's this toing and froing between conductor and character. But what now came into my mind was that maybe that there was some kind of private game going on here on the stage, you know, between perhaps the conductor and the singer. And that maybe, just as the conductor was conducting events in the pit, Gurnemanns was conducting events on the stage. Now, bearing this in mind, I'd like to think about the scene in Act 3 in which Parsifal, now equipped with the spear and his newfound Mitleid, or compassion, seeks to return to Amfortas, whose agony he had witnessed in Act 1, but the meaning of which had only become apparent to him after the encounter with Kundry in Act 2. Another, you know, thing, this is Netrogelijkheit, really. Now, at this point, Gurnemanns confronts him with the fact that during his wanderings, Amfortas has refused to uncover the Grail and to give sustenance to the Brotherhood. And as a result, Amfortas's father, Titurel, the Grail King, has died, unnourished, a man like all men, as he sings. Now, this revelation unleashes an anguished stream of singing, really anguished stream of singing from Parsifal, which places him on the same level, qua sufferer, as Amfortas himself. He sings these words, "And it is I who caused all of this woe. Ah, what transgression, what burden of guilt." Nietzsche, again in the Genealogy of Morals, discusses the invention of conscience, which he describes as a form of torture based on the remembrance of debt. Only something that hurts incessantly is remembered. He goes on to write that things never proceed without blood, torture, and victims, in his, you know, his very graphic style, when man thinks it necessary to forge a memory for himself. Now here it just felt like Gurnemanns' words were almost burning a memory into Parsifal. And it was like an act of verbal torture. And, you know, in Nietzsche's estimation, acts through the sophisticated mechanism of guilt. Now, in the last book of the genealogy, Nietzsche attempts to uncover how this mechanism of memory through guilt first came to become the dominant narrative in human history, what he describes as the slave revolt in morals. Now, in order to explain this shift from the noble period, which is characterized by instinctive strength, to the slave period, which is characterized by what he calls resentment, or going back, you know, resentment about, you know, so there's nothing instinctive about this. He imagines a figure called the ascetic priest, who is both, in his words, sick and strong, and must defend his herd or his community against health. Now, the ascetic priest harnesses the power of the sick by creating a kind of emotional medication, by turning the blame for their sickness back on themselves, and thus creating the concept of sin for Nietzsche. And Nietzsche describes the concept of sin as the greatest event in the history of the sick soul. Now, whilst keeping the individual souls sick, this medicine, sin, creates a will to reciprocity in the emergence of communities, or Nietzsche's notion of the herd. So what we have is we're going from the solitary noble being and replacing that by the community of the sick. Now Nietzsche writes, the masterstroke which the ascetic priest permitted himself in order to play the heart-rending and enraptured music of all kinds upon the human soul was, as everyone knows, his exploitation of the sense of guilt. Now, by interpreting Gurnemanz's actions in Act 3 through the lens of Nietzsche's ascetic priest, you know, we get a very different Gurnemanz to the one that we would expect. So Parsifal, after expressing the guilt for which his process of Bildung throughout the opera has conditioned him, is offered by Gurnemanz not a cure for the cause of guilt, but the substitute satisfaction promised by an albeit rather peculiar brand of Christianity, which for Nietzsche was the great treasure house of the most ingenious consolations. The flowers then that bloom in Act 3 in that wonderful passage of the Good Friday music, they don't bloom through any natural impulse. They bloom due to the tears of repentant sinners. And all creation gives thanks. And in this way, nature is absolved. You know, sin is permeating all of this scene, you know. So in Nietzschean terms then, this building, this development of the main character echoes that of the history of humanity. So we have the hero, initially noble, becomes sick through the sense of guilt which is implanted within him, and then finally tamed when he enters the religious community. It's hardly surprising, then, that in the final scene of this production, the bit where it just cut out, and the bit where Mark just spilled the beans a little bit earlier in his talk, that our Grail Knight, Gurnemanz, when he witnesses the coming together of Amfortas and Kundry at the front of the stage, and he's powerless to prevent it, subtly walks towards them and slips a knife into Kundry's back, helping her, in Wagner's words, sink lifeless to the ground. Now, every community must be founded on a sacrifice. For Freud, in Totem and Taboo, he suggested that the original sacrifice took place in a Darwinian primal horde, whereby the sons grouped together to murder the father and were then bound by affective ties of guilt, as the original act became ritualized in the totemic mill. And for René Girard, in Violence and the Sacred, all religious rites share the common thread of an original murder, which was crucial to the foundation of society. As crucial, indeed, as the rites themselves are to the society's continuance. Now, what I think we get then in Chechnyakov's production, what he shows us, perhaps, is not only the knife which commits this act, but just a very small, subtle glimpse at the hand that wields it. Thank you.